Greetings, Liddell. This is Bob Rouse, your host to the Grace Radio series Voices. This adventure in programming for Grace Radio features the voices of our neighbors here in Slidell about matters of community interest. And today our guest is Mr. Vinnie Labello, an attorney here in Slidell, has worked for the DA's office in the past, and he's a candidate now for Judge District F, I believe, 22nd Judicial District. We're honored to have Vinnie with us to talk to us today a little bit. So welcome, Vinnie. Glad you're here.
Good morning, Bob. Thank you so much for having me.
Glad you're here, sir. This is a pretty big job you're shooting for. Is this your first elected adventure?
It is a big job. It is not the first time I've run for office. I actually ran for city court judge way back in 2004.
Okay.
I've been practicing law for about 5 years.
Uh-huh. And
in that case, the qualifications under the statute for to be elected to that position was you have been practicing law for 5 years at the time of the primary election. I actually got sued in that campaign by one of my colleagues here in Slidell, another lawyer. It was me and two other candidates. Actually, one of those other candidates is running for the city court judge seat now.
Okay.
In the lawsuit at the trial court, the trial judge ruled in our favor. The First Circuit Court of Appeal ruled in our favor, and the Supreme Court reversed that, and they changed the law, making the qualifications or interpreting that five-year qualification to be that you had to have 5 years of practice at the time of the primary.
Yeah, I'm sure that was a moment of disappointment for you, but the good thing is it has you open and free today to look for to run for District F.
Yes, you're correct.
Well, tell us a bit about yourself, where you come from, and who are you?
I am 49 years old. I actually grew up in Akron, Ohio. I've been raised there until I was 18 and uh-huh. graduated from high school. I went to Akron St. Vincent St. Mary High School, which most people, probably younger people, will recognize as the high school of LeBron James, the basketball player.
Okay.
I went to school, undergraduate school at University of Southern Mississippi in Hattiesburg. And that was in 1988, and I've been down here since.
The wonderful climate we have and all the good food just attracted you. You didn't have a choice.
That's
you had to stay.
That and the people, yes.
Wonderful, wonderful. So that was in Southern Mississippi, and then you end up in Slidell?
Yes, I went to school in Hattiesburg. One of my roommates lives here in Slidell. His family lives here. His father had a business, and I actually worked for his father for a few years after I graduated.
Okay. And you had your law degree when you moved to Slidell?
No, that was straight. I moved to Slidell right after I graduated from USM.
Okay.
So I was 22.
Okay.
I just graduated from, you know, I had my undergraduate degree. And I worked in, it's an oil field service business. I worked mm-hmm. there for a few years. And then I went to law school.
Okay. In New Orleans?
I went to Loyola University in New Orleans.
Loyola, okay. My brother graduated as a lawyer. Well, good. There's a lot of local people have gone there and then stayed around to practice. So you got your law degree from Loyola and decided to immediately open an office?
No. So I graduated from Loyola in 1999.
Okay.
And of course, when you graduate from law school, you're not automatically a lawyer. You have to sit for and take and pass the bar exam.
Right.
Which I did shortly after graduation. And fortunately, I passed the bar exam. And I had a job waiting for me at the district attorney's office here in St. Tammany Parish.
Oh, great.
So that's where I started my career.
How long did you stay with the DA?
I was at the DA's office for about 5 years until 2004. And I actually left the DA's office at time because a lawyer friend of mine here in Slidell was a JAG officer in the Army Reserves. His unit got activated and deployed, and he had to go away to Iraq for a year. So he needed someone to cover his practice while he was gone. So that's when I left the DA's office.
Well, that really disrupts a life when you get called up in the middle of a professional career.
It sure did. He had four kids, actually high school and younger at the time. He was around 50 years old. It's a tough time in life to have that, you know, that kind of disruption in your life. But he's a better man than me. He's a patriot, and he's somebody I really look up to. So I'm glad I was able to help him out with that. And we've been friends, very close friends ever since.
Well, he's fortunate to have someone like you to be able to step in and keep it going and have something there when he got back.
Well, I was glad to help.
Good. So what happens after this?
So I also, at the time, entered into private practice. Now, his practice was limited to a particular type of case, injury cases. So that's all he does in his practice. So I was doing that, and I was starting to develop and build my own private practice at the same time. Now, I have two partners. There's three of us. All three of us worked together at the district attorney's office and left at various times, and we ended up forming a firm. One of my partners' name is Vincent Wynn. The other partner's name is Jeremy Goo. They're both from the west side of the parish.
Okay.
And we've been together since.
Well, that's great. And you're still in the same partnership with these guys?
Still in the same partnership. Now, we have a large office in Covington, and I have a small office here in Slido.
Okay. Well, it's amazing that you've been in partnership with other attorneys for that long.
When you put attorneys in a room for too long, you have some dissension in the ranks, huh?
Well, there's always moving around. It keeps the sign business going.
You're right. No, we're good friends. All three of us are like-minded, so we've had no issues with that in our partnership.
Well, great. So the experience is as a prosecutor, your experience in injury cases for your friend when he was gone, and now your own experience for a number of years has brought you to the point where you want to make a change.
Right. So I've been practicing law for 20 years. Like we said, the first 5 of those years was as an assistant district attorney prosecuting criminal cases.
Okay.
And when I left, as we mentioned, I was handling I call him JP. His name's John Perry. I was handling his injury cases, but I was also developing my own personal practice. Now, in my practice over the years since I left the DA's office, it's a broad mix of cases. I'd say about a third of it's plaintiff's work, a third of it's defense work, and a third of it is just general civil commercial litigation. I represent a lot of local businesses. I also have been privileged to represent local police officers on the North Shore through their police association on various matters. That's something that I'm very proud of, and I'm honored that I like to brag about the fact that they chose me to represent them and be their attorney. So that's kept me busy, too.
Absolutely. Before we get on talking about the judge seat that you're running for, tell me a little bit about things that you enjoy doing on the side. You, like many attorneys, I suppose, are something of a workaholic, but there must be something that you do that you find pleasure in.
I do. I work a lot. I like to try to stay physically fit. I'm trying to fight the aging process. You know how that goes. That's both an interest and a hobby and something I do for my health, but I do that. I really enjoy spending time with my daughters, and I try to do that as much as possible.
Okay.
Now, they're spread out. My oldest is in Baton Rouge, and my youngest is a little bit closer here in Loyola. So we like to travel when we get an opportunity to do that. I used to do some hunting and fishing. That's kind of dwindled down in the last 5-10 years. Just, I don't know if it's a matter of losing interest or really losing time.
It takes a lot of time to do that, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So I try to stay busy working and spending time with my daughters.
Well, that's a good thing to be doing with your life. So let's just talk about this Division F seat with the 22nd Judicial District. Why?
Well, Judge Cody, who's currently the judge in Division F, is retiring. So in Louisiana, we have mandatory age retirement for judges. And he's hit that age, and he's actually, I think, retiring before he would be forced to retire, but he can't run again, so he's retiring. So his seat is vacant, and it's open. The reason that I chose to run for this seat, I've been thinking about it for the last couple of years. Over my career, I've gone back and forth with the idea of running for public office. Usually thought has been to run for judge, to be a judge. And depending on the circumstances and what's going on in my life over the years, I've considered it and shied away from it, and you know, had other priorities and other interests that I needed to tend to first. I think a big part of it's the point I've gotten to in my life. I'm 50 years old. Both of my daughters are grown. They're out of the house. They're in college. They're going to be spreading their wings and flying soon on their own. My oldest, she just took the MCAT. She's going to be going to medical school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, following in the footsteps of her mother. So there's no telling where she's going to end up, but she'll be in medical school and then off practicing medicine in the near future. Time flied.
Yeah, it does.
It's amazing how when they seems like just yesterday they were little girls, but time flew by very fast. And my youngest, of course, is doing her second year at Loyola. So she's going to be graduating from school and starting a career on her own. So at this point in my life, in terms of family and family obligations mm-hmm. and time, it's the right time for me. This
Good
point
time.
In my career as a lawyer, it's the right time for me. I'm you know, at an age where I've been practicing law for long enough to have the experience, you know, the wherewithal to actually handle the responsibilities of a judge. And financially, same thing. To be honest with you, although a judge's salary is a healthy salary and you can live fine off a judge's salary, it's considerably less than a lot of lawyers make in a private practice of law. And it's considerably less than, you know, I'm used to making in the past years. And now I just, with the kids grown and out of the house, still paying for college and those, you know, those expenses.
Sure.
Yeah, financially, the timing was good for me.
Just a good time for you. Just a good time. I know we're limited, different than other elections where candidates will tell what they're going to do in the future, and I'm going to fix this and I'm going to do that. Of course, judge races are really quite different, aren't they?
They are. We are severely restricted by the judicial canons, and those are rules that the Supreme Court adopted and promulgate that govern the behavior of judges and judge candidates. So as a judge candidate, I'm subject to those rules. And the most important one are in terms of campaigning and politics, and when you're out talking to people trying to get them to learn who you are and what you stand for and what you're about, is a canon that prohibits us from making any kind of comment or taking a position on any issue that is either likely to or may come before the court. And that's a pretty broad scope of things that we're prohibited from commenting on. So that makes it a little bit difficult.
In Division F, you would see all kind of cases, wouldn't you? Criminal,
yes,
as well as civil and,
yes,
family cases.
Well, in Division F, in the 22nd Judicial District Court encompasses all of St. Tammany and all of Washington Parish.
Okay.
So it's two parishes. Then maybe 5-10 years ago, the legislature passed statute and we actually formed two family court divisions.
Okay.
And we have two family court judges, and those divisions, those judges hear family court matters and juvenile matters. So they're going to hear the divorce cases, child custody, visitation, adoptions, juvenile cases. And generally, those cases don't go to the other regular divisions of the court, like Division F. Occasionally, for various reasons, those two family court judges either have to recuse themselves from a case because of a relationship with one of the parties or a witness involved, or maybe even one of the lawyers involved, or for some other reason. And when that happens, those family type cases or juvenile cases get reallotted and sent to one of the regular divisions. So it's possible that, you know, occasionally those types of cases will be before Division F, the seat I'm running for. But generally speaking, those types of cases stay in the family courts.
Well, your broad experience that you've had, your district attorney experience and these other areas of law that you practice, has really prepared you well to be able to hear almost anything.
That's one of the main reasons that I'm running, and that's one of the main reasons I feel strongly that I'm very well qualified to run for this seat. And not just the broad spectrum or type of cases that I've handled. I've handled those cases on both sides. I've been a prosecutor. I've prosecuted criminal cases, and I've done defense work and represented defendants. I've represented plaintiffs in all types of cases, injury cases and contract disputes, you name it. And I've also represented individuals and businesses on the defense side. So I've been on both sides of all these cases, and that's what you get in the regular divisions, in district court, in Division F. You're going to get a very broad scope of cases that come before that court, and it's very much like my experience that I've had over the 20 years of practicing law. So I think it's a very good fit from my experience.
Well, good. What can you bring of your personal being into that judgeship? Seems to me that you're restricted, like you said, in so many areas, and you have to follow the law. But still, there are portions of you that have to bleed through somewhere. Where's that spot?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. And that is a difficult one to answer because of the restrictions we have. But I can answer that without getting close to violating those restrictions.
Okay, good.
It's hard for people who aren't in the legal profession to conceptualize or understand this. But look, lawyers and judges, they're human beings. Every human has the same tendencies. We're all built the same way. We all react the same way. And we all have our outlook on life based on our personal experience in life. And that goes also for your practice of law. And it goes all the way from as a small child, the way you're raised and the way you're brought up and the type of education you get, all the way through college, graduate school, starting your whatever career you go into, in this case as a lawyer, all the way through. Every one of us is human. The notion that we can just remove our own personal experience and personal thoughts from any process is difficult to explain or discuss with people who aren't lawyers or who aren't in the judicial system. But the number one thing that a judge has to do, has to be able to do, is decide each and every case based on the law and the facts or the merits of the case. And sometimes a judge has to make a decision that's not consistent with his own personal beliefs or his own personal opinion. And that's the way the law works. That's the way our system works. That's the way it has to be. And oftentimes, as a judge, you have to know that you have two parties. And they're, if they're in court, they obviously have a dispute that they couldn't resolve themselves. And they had to hire lawyers or to get involved in the court process. So you're put in a position as a judge where you have to make a decision. You know, at least one of the parties is not going to be happy with your decision. Hmm. And you have to make that decision. And the number one criteria, and really the sole criteria that judges are required to make those decisions on, is number one, the law and the facts of the merits of each case. And so, yes, personal beliefs, of course, and personal experience come into that. In my case, what I'm proud of and what I'm trying to talk about and get people to understand is what we touched on earlier. I think the fact that I have experience practicing law on both sides of the case is a big advantage for me. And the reason for that is what we talked about, what I mentioned earlier, is everybody's personal experience. I have experience seeing how people are affected and the viewpoints of both sides of those cases. And that's on any type of case, whether it's a criminal case, whether it's an injury case, it's contract dispute, across the board. And just like everything else in life, unless you've been able to personally experience and see or been close to somebody's circumstances or a situation that they're in, it's very difficult to understand that. And that's true in the legal profession. It's true for judges. And it's that experience and that understanding of both sides of the case that's what really gives a person, any person, the ability to have that empathy and that understanding. And without that understanding, it's, in my view, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to make a balanced decision or evaluation of cases that you need to make. Now, ultimately, you're making your decision based on the law because that's what we're obligated to do and that's the way the system works. But you have to understand both sides to be able to do that. And that experience that I have, I think, is very important and is going to be a big part in allowing me to be the type of judge I want to be.
You know, it seems to me that two character traits would be very important. One is integrity and the other one's discipline. Particularly if you're hearing a case in which maybe your personal feelings are one thing, but you have to stick with the facts. So to be a person of integrity, you have to have integrity towards your guidelines, your rules, the laws, the history, all of those things, but also the discipline. I have a face that's usually pretty easy to read, and I can imagine you rolling your eyes on the bench and making faces is probably not acceptable.
That would not be considered professional, but it certainly happens.
Yeah.
And that is the tough part about the job. But, you know, this is the job I want. This is the job I'm looking for, and I'm ready for that. You know, and it's a challenge to be in a position where you have to make decisions and make rulings that are going to affect people's lives deeply a lot of times based on the law. And oftentimes or sometimes you have to do that when it may be contrary to your own personal beliefs on certain underlying issues. And that's right. Just the way it has to be.
It sounds like it's a great place for you and a great place for your professional ambitions. Appreciate you taking the time to spend with us today. Is there anything you'd like to add that we maybe didn't cover or some subject that we need to discuss a little bit, the object being so people can get to know you better?
I think we've touched on pretty much everything. We talked about the fact that I've lived in Slidell since I was 22 years old. I'm almost 50 now, so it's a long time. I love living here. This is my home. This is where we raised our children. I want to stay here. I'd love for my children to stay here and want to stay here. But a big part of why I'm doing this is it's been a great place to live and to raise a family, and I want to keep it that way. And the only way that's going to happen is across the board in government, including our judicial system with judges, if we have good people who are elected into office who are willing to serve. And sometimes that involves sacrifice. Sometimes it's different types of sacrifice, but it's something that I feel called to do. I want to serve. I'm ready to serve. I think I'm qualified to serve, and I want to give back to the community and play my part. I want to keep this St. Tammany Parish and Washington Parish, the North Shore, a good place to live and raise a family, and that's what I feel like I can do to contribute to doing that.
Well, your closing statement is awesome because I continue to say St. Tammany is one of the most magnificent places to live. And of course, in your case, because you were representing Washington Parish as well, but a great place to live because we have good people in office. We've elected good people to protect our futures and protect our investments in our homes and kids. and working to provide opportunity for our kids so they can stay close to home and not have to race off to some big city someplace else. And I really appreciate you jumping on that bandwagon to want to serve to continue to build on some good foundation.
I do. Actually, that brings up, comment brought up something I would like to touch on, because I think people probably experiencing this, and relatively new, when I say relatively new, maybe over the last 5-10 years, we're now having a bigger and bigger spread problem with drugs, and particularly the opiates. And I say more widespread because I think it's becoming more and more prevalent on the North Shore in St. Tammany Parish. It used to be people had to go across the lake to buy those type of harder drugs. Heroin in particular is what I'm talking about. And nowadays, it's easily obtainable here, right here in St. Tammany Parish, in Slidell. And it's really becoming, you know, I don't want to sound too cliche, but it is an epidemic, and it's getting worse and worse. And people can't understand how deeply that affects not just the person who becomes addicted to the drugs, to heroin or to opiates, but their family.
Yes.
And not just their family, their neighbors. And it's unfortunate that people who don't have that experience with someone who's close to them having an addiction and all the problems that come along with the addiction. Of course, with the business I've been in and with the judge seat that I'm running for, we don't deal with that as a professional until somebody gets in trouble with the law, if they're caught in possession of it. Now, I'm talking about people who are using, who have an addiction, dependency on drugs. And again, I'm talking about heroin. I'm not talking about the dealers, people who are in the business of selling poison and destruction and death. That's a whole different ballgame. People who are selling those drugs that are causing all the deaths and the overdoses and all the family destruction and the chaos, they need to be dealt with harshly. Okay, we have laws. I can't comment specifically on how positions I'd take on any cases as a judge, but I can tell you that I view those people who are pushing those drugs in our community, on our people, completely differently than we view people who are using them and buying them. A lot of people don't understand addiction, and that's probably because I keep coming back to people's personal experience in their lives. If you don't know somebody who's truly been an addict, a lot of people think that that's just a choice people make. And sure, it's a choice at some point to get to start.
Right.
But once you become physically dependent, chemically dependent on these drugs, if you're anybody who knows somebody that's had that type of addiction, you know it's not a choice. Nobody chooses to live their life like that. Nobody chooses to do what an addict does to his family, to his parents, to his siblings. And that goes across the board, from stealing from your own family just to support your habit.
Yes.
Children, you know, I say children, and I'm not talking about kids, I'm talking about young adults, doing the most horrible things to their parents and their family, the people that love them the most, from everything from stealing to lying to you name it, the just absolute destruction to those families. Nobody chooses to do that. Nobody does. It's they act that way because they're physically addicted. So the point I'm trying to make is I think I'm sensing a better understanding in the community of the effects that addiction has, not only on the addict, but the families. And with the growth of that as a problem and becoming what we're calling an epidemic, I'm hoping that understanding continues to grow. And because I think the solution to this problem is you know, it's got to be attacked on two sides. On the drug dealer side, of course, we have to have tough laws, and we have to have tough penalties for people who are selling drugs and who are profiting off the death and the destruction and the just ruination of these people's families. So that's on the supply side of the drug problem. And on the demand side, you're talking about the people who are out buying the drugs and using them and become addicted. We need to figure out a better solution than just getting them immediately into the criminal justice system, having them, number one, be convicted felons, because most of the drugs I'm talking about, particularly heroin, most of them, if you get caught in possession of those, it's a felony. And having a felony conviction on your record has long-lasting, deep impact on your life.
Yes,
now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't. That's the law. Okay, it's illegal to possess those things. But we talked earlier, I think, off the air about some discretion that people have in all businesses, but in the criminal justice system. And I think that everybody needs to start using a little bit of discretion in those circumstances, because it's not too difficult to take a look at somebody and make a determination whether they're someone who's a user who has a drug problem, or they're somebody who's really a more hardened criminal who may be a threat to the community and to our safety. And certainly you can look at at the level of a police officer on the street. They have immediate access to that person's rap sheet. What I'd like to see, I was talking about attacking this problem on two sides. I want to attack the distribution, the supply side, hard and harshly. I want to squash it, whatever it takes. And that's what the law has to do, and that's my personal position on that. And that, of course, has to be done within the law and the statutes that we have. What I'd like to see continue to grow is a little bit more understanding of how deeply families and people are affected on the demand side, the users and the people with the dependency, and have more options available to try to solve that solution, because it on the demand side, because it does have to be attacked from both sides, because as long as there's a demand for it, people are going to be willing to bring it, to import it, bring it in and sell it, because they're making a lot of money doing it.
Sure.
So you have to attack it from both sides. I hope that everybody continues to stay with the trend that I'm seeing, and when I'm out in the community talking to people about this issue, and I think what y'all do here and the faith-based groups can play a huge role in that, and can be probably the most effective in getting these people in touch with people who can give them the guidance, get them into treatment programs.
Yes, that's right. That's
and
right.
Actually hold their hand through that process, because I'm telling you, I've seen it time and time again with people. Generally, they're younger people. When I say younger, I'm talking about 20s, 30s, who become addicted to these drugs. And usually the process is they start with pills. Maybe it's pain pills, the opiate pain pills. And then for whatever reason, your body physically, you develop a chemical dependency on that substance. And your body has to have it. You literally get sick, ill, if you don't have it. And people just don't think right when they have – they just don't have the ability to think right psychologically because of the chemical effect on their body. And when they no longer have the ability or the availability of those pills to get that chemical in their system, then they move on to the cheaper and more dangerous drug, which is heroin. And I won't beat a dead horse, but we're all hearing and seeing stories about – how heroin is being cut with very, very dangerous and very, very powerful drugs. Fentanyl was one that was talked about most recently. And not last week or the week before, I was talking to our coroner, Dr. Preston. He was telling me that now they're cutting it with another variation of fentanyl. I don't remember the chemical name of it. I leave that to my genius daughter who's studying biochemistry and is going off to medical school. It's a lot of letters and syllables that I can't pronounce, but this substance or this form of fentanyl is, I think he said, 11 times stronger than fentanyl, which is fentanyl was crazy powerful anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's done to cut it and to make it more profitable for the drug dealers. Of course, what it's doing is nobody knows what's in the dose. If you're a heroin user, you don't know what's in there. You don't know how it's cut. You don't know where it came from. And frankly, they don't care because they're addicts. They're looking for a fix. So that's why we're seeing such an increase in the amount of overdoses and deaths. And that's why you see a lot of media coverage of police officers and EMS, different agencies trying to make the Narcan shot and treatment available, because we're having so many incidents of overdoses. And that's something also that I think, I don't know where the funding for that comes from, but our first responders certainly have to have an abundant supply of the Narcan and whatever else it takes to treat those overdoses. And if they don't have the funding for that, we need to find that public funding. If we can't find public funding, I would like to see private organizations, whether it be faith-based organizations or otherwise, supplement whatever budgets they need to get those to get that Narcan and whatever else is needed to those first responders and anywhere else in the community, so that if somebody's overdosing, we do everything we can to save that life. It's a human life. Whether you, regardless of how you feel about drug users, drug use, addiction, that's a human life. That's somebody's son, daughter. That's somebody's brother and sister. It's probably, some of them are parents. They're human lives, and that should be our number one concern. I'm glad that that's a topic of conversation. That's a subject. I'm a little bit sorry that I'm restricted on what I can say about that, but that's something that I've experienced quite a bit of in my practice of law, and it's heart-wrenching to see that. And I know that what we're doing now is on the demand side with users and with people who have that dependency is not enough, and that's not the solution. The solution is not to be harsh on them in terms of the criminal justice system. We don't need to be incarcerating those people who are addicted. You know, we have a drug court program, which I want to get very involved with.
Diversion.
Diversion is something different. Diversion is a pretrial program, and that's, say for example, you're out on the street and you're a heroin user.
Okay.
You get pulled over on a traffic stop, and for some reason the police officer, you either give them consent to search your vehicle, the police officer has probable cause for whatever reason, they find the heroin in your possession. You get arrested for possession of heroin. That's a felony charge. They're going to put you in handcuffs. They're going to take you to the jail. They're going to lock you up. In that process, you have a constitutional right to bail, to be bonded out of jail. So a bond's going to be set, and hopefully you're going to have somebody who has a little bit of money who can bond you out, family or whatever. You get out of jail, and you await trial. You're served with an arraignment date. In the meantime, whoever the arresting agency was, let's say it's Slidell Police Department. Those are my friends over at Slidell Police Department. They do a great job, and they're very active and proactive in their enforcement. Let's say it's the Slidell PD who actually arrested you and made the case. They're going to complete their paperwork. They're going to send that paperwork to the district attorney's office. At the district attorney's office, this is going to go through what's called a screening process. Mm-hmm. And that's where an assistant district attorney, an ADA, reads through the case and make a determination. Is there enough evidence here to support a prosecution? Is there enough evidence where we can prosecute this case and prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? In the screening process, the DA's office has absolute discretion. They can accept the charge. They can refuse the charge. They can charge you for whatever they want. Absolute discretion. But diversion, which you were talking about before, that's all through the DA's office. And that can happen
okay. After
an arrest and when the report and that case file gets forwarded from the arresting agency to the DA's office. And the DA's office, that's a program that is run exclusively by the district attorney. It's 100% within their discretion whether to offer diversion to somebody. I feel strongly that the DA's office should be using that program very frequently with the group of people we've been talking about, people who have addictions or chemical dependencies.
Right.
And that's not just for heroin, for other substances, all the way across the board, alcohol, everything else. And they are, the DA's office does do that. But that's a process that you go through. So essentially, it's an informal probation process you go through with the district attorney's office.
Well, it seems like there's the need for, and I think you've described it well, cooperation among everybody involved in the process. Beginning with the guy on the street and understanding the horror of what a drug dealer is doing to the DA, who understands what's happening, all the way through the court system.
All the way through the court system.
Because if they go through all of this and the judge gets out there and he says, well, I'm going to sentence you to 30 days and the rest of your life, I'm going to sentence you to 30 days and let them go. You know, if we don't have a consistent approach to it, and I hear you saying that you, I think you said the courts ought to deal as harshly as possible with the supply side.
Yes.
And I think that just again adds to the quality of life, because we're not struggling against each other saying I'm the most important part.
Right.
But rather what we're saying is I am a part of something that's really good and functioning well in St. Tammany Parish.
Exactly. And you're right. It needs to be cooperation. But it's not just in the law enforcement and judicial process. It's in the community, like
yes.
We talked about before. And you know, some, it's so, you see particularly with heroin, the opiates, you'll see people who go through treatment, and treatment is not cheap. That's another thing that we need to do something about. You'll see people go through treatment programs time and time again, and they'll get clean and they relapse. It's just, that's how strong, that's how powerful that dependency is. And people just keep ending up going back to that. It's like it's calling to them, and they go to it. And it's, I believe, because of what I've seen, and I've seen it up close with clients and their family, that's not a choice people make. Nobody chooses to live like that. So we have to have that understanding. But I think more than just in the law enforcement and the judicial community, we need to do more in our community, in the private sector, and with particularly with the faith-based organizations, because they're set up to do that.
Right.
Maybe not specifically with chemical dependency, but they have the outreach programs and the people to do that.
Well, Dr. Preston is very much active in that area in our community in terms of getting people better and providing mental health services as well. And I think it was President Pat Brister who had the courage to lead us into a safe haven. So, you know, there's some good stuff happening out there. And you're right. It's more than law enforcement. It takes mental health. It takes the faith-based community reaching out to people who are suffering. I know there's a number of churches, particularly here in Slidell, that deal with hurting people.
Yes.
Some of it is not with drug related, like grief share, but other parts are for the families dealing with the repercussions of this. So it does take a war cooperation. And you're right. It's not just law enforcement. It's everybody putting their best efforts on the table.
And I think what I'd like to do, whether I'm elected judge or not, what I'd like to do more of, particularly if I'm elected judge, is reach out to the community, get out in the community with these organizations, because I think there's a whole lot of people who just don't understand this problem because they don't have the personal experience with
it. You're exactly right. I think you've hit on something there.
And they don't understand what happens when somebody who has that dependency, that addiction, gets tied up into the criminal justice system. And I think if people saw that and really understood it, it might change their thoughts on it and their viewpoint on it. And I think that's what needs to happen. We have to have a shift. And I think it is happening. I'd like to see it happen faster. But we need to have a shift in how we look at these problems. Because while everybody's trying and everybody's doing the best they can, you can just look at the numbers and the statistics and read the newspaper and see it's not working or it's not working well enough. It's going to continue to grow as a problem. It's going to be something we need to try different approaches.
Right. And it's going to take all of us to make it happen.
It's going to take all of us, the whole community.
Can't take anybody out the circle.
Exactly.
Well, it's been certainly a pleasure talking with you. And I'm glad we added this last segment about the opioid crisis, because it is something that's on everybody's mind. We hear a lot about it in the news, and it's touched a lot of lives, too.
It sure has.
So thank you for opening the door and letting us see a little bit about who you are and what you will bring to the seat. It's been a good conversation. I thank you for it.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you for having me, and thank you to your listeners for taking the time to listen.
And thank you, Slidell, for tuning in to Voices here on Grace Radio. We want to hear from you. You can give us a call now at 985-250-1037. Send us a text. Leave a comment. We want to hear from you. We'd also encourage you to like us on Facebook, Grace Radio Slidell. Also, we have a website, www.graceradioslidell.net. There you can make tax-deductible gifts to support the station. We very much appreciate the support from all of our listeners. And again, the number to call is 985-250-1037. Today's program has been hosted by myself, Bob Riles, and produced by Don Morales, your Grace Radio Voices team. Hope you enjoyed it. Well, that's it for now. Join us again daily for Voices of Slidell at 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. and get in the flow of God's grace here in Slidell.